Thank you. Be seated. Court is now ready to hear oral arguments in Allied General Agency Incorporated in Poland versus Moody and Lyons versus Miller's Casualty Insurance Company of Texas, which have been combined for oral arguments.
May it please the court, Ms. Joanne Wilkins and Mr. Scott Stolle will present arguments for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Joanne Wilkins and I represent Allied General Agency and John Michael Poland in the Allied General Agency versus Moody case. The broad issues that I see before this court by these two cases is whether a judgment that doesn't have any pleadings or findings to support it can stand, and whether a finding of a breach of a duty of good faith and fair dealing can stand when there is evidence in the record of a reasonable basis for the denial of the claim. Because of the overlap of the issues in these two cases and the time constraints, and with the court's permission, I will address the first broad issue, and Mr. Stolle, who represents Miller's Mutual, will address the second. Of course, I'll answer any questions the court would ask, and I would submit all of the points of error that are in the application for writ of error, even should I not have time to get to them. Within the issue on the pleadings and findings to support the judgment are issues concerning application of this court's decision in Vail and an issue regarding whether conscious indifference under a gross negligence definition is the same as a statutory finding of knowingly required for multiple statutory damages. The trial court and the Court of Appeals used Vail to enter and affirm a judgment for actual damages, multiple statutory damages, and attorney's fees. And the actual damages is based on a finding of a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, which according to Vail is a unlisted deceptive trade practice under Section 1746 of the DTPA, which an act under 1746 becomes a violation of Article 2121, Section 16 of the Insurance Code. The additional statutory damages were awarded because the breach of that duty of good faith and fair dealing was held to be or found to be committed with conscious indifference. When you look at the pleadings and the jury issues that actually exist in the Moody case, they don't support that judgment. Mr. Moody pleaded a violation of Article 2121. He separately pleaded a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. Nowhere in his petition did he allege that that breach of the duty was an unlisted deceptive trade practice act under Section 1746 A or B. And in fact, he specifically pleaded two violations under 1746 B of the DTPA. Now in the Lyons case, Mrs. Lyons pleaded Article 2121, and then she specifically pleaded that it had been violated by acts under board orders and by violations of Section 4 of the Insurance Code. She also separately pleaded the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. She did not plead that it was an unlisted deceptive act, and in fact, she did not plead any violation of 1746, whether listed or unlisted. Mr. Moody did not plead for multiple statutory damages under Article 2121. Every reference in his pleading is to the DTPA. Now, the jury issues that actually were submitted in this case dealt with the contract claim or the coverage claim, the violation of Article 2121, Section 16 through a violation of Section 4, and a violation of 1746 B, 7, and 23, and then the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. There was not an issue submitted as to whether the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing was a deceptive trade practice. The jury found against the plaintiff on his 2121 claim and on his 1746 claim. Although the jury did find for the plaintiff on his contractual claim and for his section 1758-3 claim, which is the unconscionability action under the DTPA, those would only support recovery of actual damages in this case and do not provide any support for multiple statutory damages. The finding is the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, and that was recognized as a common law cause of action, as a distinct tort action. Now, assuming it can be an unlisted deceptive act under Section 1746, shouldn't there be pleading, proof, and finding required? And if they're not required, why not? Is this lack of pleading requirement that the courts are reading out of this court's bail decision just for the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, or all, and then all the others must be pleaded and proved? Where does it stop? The plaintiff pleaded these specific acts. He got his issue under 1746, and he didn't prevail on it. He didn't ask the court to submit an unlisted deceptive trade practice under that. He pleaded 2121, and he got his issue. He didn't include a violation of 1746, or a deceptive act under 1746, as a violation of Article 2121, Section 16, in his issue. So, having submitted them in that manner, is he not confined to those theories? As I stated, trial courts and the Court of Appeal have apparently construed this court's decision in Vail to have done away with the pleading requirement. And if that, in fact, is correct, then I think it's a denial of the defendant's right to have to know the allegations against him so that he can prepare his defense. And it also makes a mockery of the rules regarding pleadings and special exceptions. To have required a special exception in this case is almost absurd, because until Vail was decided, the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing was not held to be a deceptive act under 1746, such that you're asking, I guess, the plaintiff to tell you whether he's going to create or come up with some new theory of recovery that has not yet been recognized. If Vail doesn't do away with the pleading requirement, then the judgment in the Moody case cannot stand as it is now entered. Besides using the Vail case as a substitute for pleading, Vail raises some problems and questions that need to be answered. It results in the anomaly that a common law cause of action is a statutory violation under Article 21, Section 16, but that is not a violation of Section 1746 of the DTPA, on which recovery under Article 2121 depends. And it's not actionable under the DTPA because it's, or I submit that it's not, because it is an enlisted act. And under the language of the DTPA, it's questionable whether there's a private cause of action remaining for unlisted deceptive acts. Moreover, it's post-loss conduct that is not actionable under the DTPA, based on the very language of that statute and this court's decision in Royal Globe versus Bar Consultants. So I guess the question is a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing a deceptive act under 1746 of the DTPA? And
to the extent that any of that constitutes an anomaly, isn't it an anomaly that arises out of the fact that the insurance industry is treated separately under the insurance code rather than being treated solely like all other industries under the DTPA?
Well, the courts have consistently held that the insurance industry is subject not only to the insurance code but to the DTPA, where the converse is not necessarily true for other trades and businesses. I think the very express language of 2121 section 16, where the legislature stated that an insurance company would be subject to a violation of an act defined in 1746, was trying to confine it to those narrow issues and not opening it up to more. And I'm not sure I've answered your question. Indeed, there is an argument that 2120 or that Article 2121 is not meant to address post-loss conduct, that it, like the DTPA, is meant to address the inducement, the initial contractual arrangement. Indeed, post-loss conduct before avail was what was the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing was addressing. This court did hold in the Aetna versus Marshall case that was a settlement of a workers' comp case that a violation of 1746b5 would establish a violation of Article 2121 Section 16. I think if you look at that case, the jury finding, was based on acts in the inducement of the entering of the settlement, such that until bail, post-loss conduct was addressed by the common law cause of action. If Marshall does in fact stand for the proposition that the insurance code addresses post-loss conduct, which the DTPA does not, then I have to question why the duty of good faith and fair dealing was recognized at all, since post-loss conduct is a violation of the insurance code. I would very much, I've split my time with Mr. Stoley, and I see that I'm out of time. There are several points I do want to hit, though. I want this court to look at the Williams versus Schick case for the discussion of what is defined under 1746, because I think it has set it out much more clearly than I ever could have. With respect to the conscious indifference versus knowingly, I think this court has already addressed that issue and decided it in the Luna versus North Star Dodge case, and I would respectfully submit that under that case, the finding of conscious indifference will not support the multiple statutory damages in this case.
One question is, that even a necessary issue here, or was this tried under DTPA at the time when damages were automatically triggered?
It wasn't. This is not under the DTPA. This recovery is under the insurance code, which was amended prior to the time that the acts, which are the basis of this claim, arose, because it is not addressing acts within the making of the relationship between the insured and the insured, but it is the denial of the claim which occurred some 6 or 8 months after the policy was issued. And this court has held that the duty of good faith and fair dealing arises when the claim is wrongfully denied. So it could not have occurred prior to that time to have fallen within a separate, the previous insurance code statute.
And do I understand that the interpretation of Article 2121 that you're urging would be that it did not apply to any conduct by an insurer after a policy was issued?
Well, I think this court addressed that question in bail by holding that the determinations of law under the Arnold and Aranda decision as being deceptive acts are determinations of law under the board rules and regulations, and therefore reaches those acts. So you are reaching acts not defined in 1746. You are reaching the acts that are post-law.
I know your light's on, but I need to make one other inquiry.
Okay.
And that is, as you presented this issue, it was whether there was a reasonable basis for denying the claim.
Yes, Your Honor, that is one of the central issues in
right.
this case.
And what I want to ask you about is whether that's the full issue that we need to consider, because isn't there also a consideration here, not only as to whether there was a reasonable basis for denying the claim, but whether there was a reasonable basis for delay in denying the claim.
Your Honor, Mr. Stolle was going to address that. And
good.
Would
I'll
you,
I will raise
you.
It to him.
If there are no further questions.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
If it won't disrupt your argument too much, could you begin on that point?
Yes, Your Honor. To introduce myself, I'm Scott Stolle. I represent the Miller's Casualty Insurance Company of Texas.
And we'll give you as much extra time as we took from questions after the light.
Thank you, Chief Justice Phillips. I'm sorry, Your Honor, maybe I have to defer a little bit to Ms. Wilkins. I'm not as familiar with the facts of her case and whether indeed there was or was not a delay in denying the claim in that case. I can say for my client in the Lyons case that that is not a question that needs to be addressed by this court. My client denied Mrs. Lyons' claim within less than a month after
right.
the event occurred.
But there is a distinction in Moody, isn't there? Wasn't that a thing? You were not involved in the trial of Moody. Well, I'll wait and ask her about it.
Yeah, Ms. Wilkins will have some rebuttal
okay,
time.
I'll ask her.
In Aranda, this court stated that under the bad faith test, insurers, quote, will maintain the right to deny invalid or questionable claims and will not be subject to liability for an erroneous denial of a claim. That's how it's supposed to work in theory, but that's not how it's working in reality. Ever since Arnold, in virtually every case in which a jury has found a valid contract claim, the jury has also found bad faith. Insurers are consistently being penalized for exercising their right to open courts, their right to trial by jury, and their right to seek the very finding that is a prerequisite to whether they even have a duty to pay the claim. The root of this problem was anticipated by this court in English versus Fisher when the court decided not to adopt the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. In that case, this court recognized that to create such a new cause of action, quote, would abolish our system of government according to well-settled rules of law and let each case be decided upon what might seem fair and in good faith by each fact finder. Well, that's exactly the situation we have come to. Juries have insufficient guidance. They have free rein to do whatever they want to do, and they are in no way restricted by this court's limitation set in Aranda. Now, the appellate courts are recognizing this problem, and they're trying to deal with it as best they can. In cases such as National Union versus Hudson Energy, and the Lyons cases, and the other cases we've cited, the courts have reversed bad faith findings, or held as a matter of law that there was no bad faith. And although these courts are doing the right thing, they are also having trouble because they have insufficient guidance. These two cases today give this court an opportunity to give the juries and appellate courts more guidance. It gives you an opportunity to fulfill the promise made in Aranda. The way you can do that is to hold that the Moody and Lyons cases are examples where the claims were questionable and there was no bad faith as a matter of law.
Isn't that analogous to the Burke royalty case where you would have us find, perhaps go back to the former system of finding some evidence of care would defeat any claim to punitive damages? Here you'd say because it was arguable that defeats any jury finding or any jury question really of under Rand and Arnold.
I don't think we have the same situation as presented in Burke royalty. Gross negligence is entire want of care, such as would indicate conscious indifference. So gross negligence is not a negative, i.e., entire want of care. Gross negligence is a positive, conscious indifference. You cannot defeat a jury finding of conscious indifference by showing some care. So it's not a question of trying to use some care to defeat the negative entire want of care. You're trying to use it to defeat the positive, and I agree that cannot be done, and that's not going to work well, we hope. In this case, the way the bad faith test is set up, it's no evidence of no reasonable basis when you get up on appeal. And we have a double negative. And I question, does that mean that the double negative turns to a positive and there is no bad faith as a matter of law when there's evidence in the record that reasonable minds could differ as to whether this claim should or should not be paid?
So does that mean that if a jury determines that an insurer has acted in bad faith, but on appeal the insurer can point to any evidence that it acted in good faith, that the jury verdict will always be overturned?
I think that's a problem inherent in the bad faith definition. And I think what maybe courts are concerned about is insurance companies, among other things, manufacturing a basis to deny the claim and using that as grounds on appeal to say, well, there's some evidence here. You cannot hit us for extra contractual damages. I think the answer to that question is for this court to clarify the definition of bad faith to mean that bad faith is the knowing refusal to pay an indisputable claim. Now, that does several things. It keeps the element of scienter in there, a knowing refusal. It keeps the court's promise made in Aranda that insurance companies have the right to dispute disputable claims. The jury is asked to decide, was this claim indisputable? And thirdly, it does away with the problem of the fear of insurance companies manufacturing a basis, because in answering whether or not the claim is disputable or indisputable, the jury has a chance to look at that, and they have a chance to decide, we think that it was indisputable, their evidence was manufactured.
Thank you.
I also ask that the court look at the way the no evidence test is applied. If the court does not carve out bad faith as an exception to the no evidence application and say that when there's a reasonable basis, there's reasonable basis when reasonable minds can differ. If you cannot carve that out, look at the record. What is the evidence in the record here? The evidence shows there is some evidence that there's a covered claim. But that does not go to whether there's no reasonable basis to deny. There are two different tests, two different measures. You are looking at different things. And as a result, there is no evidence in this record of no reasonable basis to deny. You cannot necessarily infer from the evidence of a covered claim that there's no reasonable basis to deny.
Are there any questions? Outline of what the other points you would make on direct,
what is that? Yes, Your Honor. This case does not have to be decided necessarily on policy grounds. It is the Lyons case. On the bad faith point, Mrs. Lyons has failed to contest the appellate court finding that there was no evidence that Millers knew or should have known that there was no reasonable basis to deny. So there's one finding that has not been challenged, and that, therefore, their point should be overruled.
So this whole case could be resolved without dealing on the Miller case, without dealing with anything that has been discussed in argument up until this very moment?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I believe that point of error could be dealt with that way.
And that would really be the most narrow way of dealing, and direct way of dealing with this case, wouldn't it?
I agree, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Steve Sumner, Ms. Christine Carroll Robert, and Mr. William Smith will present arguments and respond.
Good morning. My name is William Smith, and I represent Jerry C. Moody, the respondent in the
case styled Allied General Agency and John Michael Poland v. Jerry C. Moody. And I want to jump to Justice Doggett's question and answer it, if I may, before I get into my presentation. Justice Doggett asked a question about the case that has not yet been answered, and that is the delay in deciding the claim in the Moody case. Originally, the denial came more than 90 days after the claim was made. The claim was made the same day of loss. An investigator was hired, an insurance investigator that only investigated for insurance companies, to investigate the claim, submitted a report in 30 days, and it took them over 60 days without gathering any additional evidence to deny the claim. There were three bases for denial of the claim. One was the failure to submit a claim form within 60 days of the date of loss. Two, overvaluation of the vehicle. And three, that the vehicle was not being used in conformity with the restrictive endorsement. Now, the evidence on the claim form was very clear. The insurance agent, Mr. Campbell, called him to claim the day of the loss. They told him, you need to submit a claim form on our form. Send it to me. He called several times. And in fact, he was ready to file a complaint with the State Board of Insurance for them failing to send the form. Finally got it. They turned it around within a couple of days. It would be on the 60-day limit. And the defendants had the audacity to take the position that it wasn't submitted timely and therefore denied the claim. Overvaluation of the vehicle. Mr. Moody paid $30,000 for the car. At the time the policy was issued, there was an appraisal submitted to the insurance company. The value of the car between $42,500 and $48,500. Never challenged. No one ever asked him to go out and get another appraisal. They never asked to have their own appraiser. And they said it was overvalued when he insured it for $40,000 less than the appraised value. And lastly, it was not being used in conformity with the restrictive endorsement. Mr. Campbell, the insurance agent, testified he had a unique automobile too. It was a Model A. He used it for promotional purposes, and he had a policy of insurance covering it. Mr. Campbell testified that he discussed with the defendants the exact use for that automobile. Mr. Campbell testified that when they sent the policy to him, he called. And this is in page approximately 48 of the appendix. He called and told the defendants, this will not work. This restrictive endorsement is not right. They asked, well, what will work? Mr. Campbell testified that he added the words and promotional purposes, which they accepted. And Mr. Campbell told them exactly what the purpose of the vehicle. And then they come back and deny the claim because it wasn't being used in accordance with the restrictive endorsement. The jury in this case heard the evidence. They are the trier of fact. And they made credibility issues part of this case. And they found against the defendants because of their conduct. Counsel for the defendant in our case wants the court to overlook the evidence and jump to reforming policy in the state of Texas. That's not necessary. The jury could have found that there was an unreasonable delay in making a determination or in denying the claim because of the conduct of the defendants. Excuse me. Additionally, Your Honor, as the court is well aware, the construction of restrictive endorsements is construed most favorably to the insurer. And I'm sure in this case the jury did just that when they found against the defendants. Skipping over to some of the claims and arguments of counsel on the DTPA, the Vail, and the insurance case. Again, I don't believe that it's necessary for the court to go this far in its ruling, but the Vail case, I believe, did hold that the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing is an unlisted deceptive act of practice. It's our position that Article 2121, Section 16, says that any practice under 1746 that's found to be deceptive is actionable under the insurance code. In this particular case, we take the position, as the court found in Vail, that the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing met the test
and conduct violated 1746. In fact, the jury found that they were grossly negligent in the breach of the duty in good faith and fair dealing. It went beyond just breaching the duty.
Why are you entitled to treble damages?
Because, Your Honor, this case arose prior to the change, the amendment of the insurance code. Counsel in her argument said this is pleaded and tried under the insurance code. It was pleaded, it was tried under the insurance code, and we're entitled to treble damages because it arose before the amendments requiring a knowing violation. The representations that were made regarding construction of the policy, restrictive endorsement, were made well before the amendment of April 4, 1985,
just
before the policy was actually issued.
If this case related to matters that arose today or since 1985, all of them arising after that time, you would not be entitled to treble damages.
Your Honor, we would then be in a position of having to argue their Luna case, and we would have a struggle with that, Your Honor. But our position has been in the Court of Appeals and before this Court that we did not have to have a knowing finding in order to prevail and to have our damages trebled.
And those representations which you refer, are those of the agents for the...
It was Allied... Yes. John Michael Poland, his lead underwriter, Allied General Agency, issued or caused the policy to be issued. There is no dispute. It was stipulated that it was a valid binding policy, that they were bound by the representations of their agent. Their agent didn't remember the representations being made. Mr. Campbell testified very positively that they were made. And in fact, he has a unique vehicle and was very certain of his understanding. In fact, Mr. Campbell testified that he has caused over 100,000 automobile policies to be issued in the state of Texas. In addition to that, Your Honor, to back up for just a moment, Mr. Campbell also testified that it's been his experience based on 70 to 80 claims per year for his life, and he was well into his 50s, that it took 15 to 45 days at most to resolve claims. It never in his experience run into the problems with the insurance carrier as he did with the defendants, and failing to get the claim forms and failing to resolve the claim more timely than over 90 days after the loss.
Mr. Smith, how do you respond to Ms. Wilkins' argument that there are no pleading evidence here to support the judgment that you seek to reaffirm?
Your Honor, I would refer the court to paragraphs the plaintiff's First Amendment original petition, which was the petition upon which we went to trial, and that we allege various acts. Count 2, paragraph 7, wherein we allege that defendants, through their duly authorized agents, represented to Moody that the loss would be insured. They failed and refused to continue and failed to refuse to pay such claims. We've alleged under paragraph 9 that the representations were committed knowingly, that they were liable to Moody for additional damages authorized by 1750 of the DTPA. We incorporated those provisions into paragraph 10, which alleged deceptive practices contrary to the Texas Insurance Code, Article 21.21. Simply, Your Honor, we gave them notice of our claims. Under Rourke v. Allen, we put them on notice of our claims. If they had a concern under what provision we were seeking damages, because we've raised them, we've raised the insurance code, we've raised the DTPA, they could very easily have filed a special exception asking us, forcing us to say, under which provision are you seeking damages? They never did that. Consequently, we believe and take the position they were put on notice of the claims by our First Amendment original petition upon which we went to trial. We would ask, Your Honor, that unless the court has some questions, the court affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals, and if the court in its wisdom decides to reverse it, to render a decision allowing us the maximum recovery under the theories found by the jury. We've got issues that were found in our favor on the contract theory. under unconscionable action or course of action under the DTPA, breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing under common law plus exemplary damages. We would ask the court to enter a judgment that the trial court should have entered if this court reverses the judgment of the Court of Appeals.
So even if the court determined that there was absolutely no evidence of the duty of good faith and fair dealing being breached here, you have a jury finding of unconscionable conduct that supports all the recovery that you received.
That is correct, Your Honor. But going to that for just a moment, I do want to reply to that comment of counsel about the standard. My concern with what they're advancing with regard to changing the standard by which we look at the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing is that there are very many instances when an insurance company will continue to receive information about a claim. At what point does one say that they crossed the line, that originally the denial may have been proper, but now they've received so much information that maybe it's improper to continue to deny the claim? And that is what occurred in one case, the Guajardo v. Liberty Mutual Insurance Company, where the insurer relied on medical expert in denying workers' compensation claim. And they said that the insurance company should be able to rely on it until contrary opinion cast down on such opinion. Again, we get back to the trier of fact. When does that occur? I submit that as it stands now, the standard as articulated by this court is proper, that juries in their wisdom can decide those factual issues, determine the credibility of witnesses, and decide whether there was a reasonable basis to deny the claim or delay payment.
So if the adjuster calls you up and says, here's what I've gotten so far, I still think the claim should be denied, but I've gotten some more evidence to the contrary. I don't think it's enough. It's arguable. What should we do? We don't want to get hit with bad faith damage at some point. Should we pay this claim or not? What's the answer?
I would suggest, Your Honor, that would be an issue as to whether they feel that there's a reasonable basis or whether they've crossed the line.
What's the lawyer's answer to his client when the adjuster calls and says, I just want to know from you, should I pay this claim or not? Here's what I got so far.
I would ask, how much evidence do they have originally and now what do they have? How did they get it? When did they get it? And what do you have?
And he tells you that.
And there is a lot of evidence that should now be paid. Originally, it shouldn't have been paid. My position would be to pay it.
Well, there's some more, but it's not conclusive either way.
We're not suggesting that the insurance company should roll the dice every time they deny a claim.
Well, how are you not suggesting that? It seems to me that what you're exactly saying is that a jury gets to sort all this out someday, so what's the harm of that? And my question is, how can you know in advance whether to do it or not? Don't you have to decide we better pay this claim?
Well, Your Honor, if I may address that question. First of all, this court decided that the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, or the duty of good faith and fair dealing, I should say, is based on a special relationship. It's higher than just a mere arm's length. It also found there's a gross disparity in bargaining power. In addition to that, that the insurance company has almost exclusive province over the insurance claim process. So if I were the insurance company lawyer, I'd say based on that special relationship you have, and we recognize special relationships in the law, if it's on a scale of 50 to 50, I'd pay it.
Don't you really have to pay it if it's 28?
No, Your Honor.
You're going to roll the dice for treble damage?
I wouldn't suggest you roll the dice. If there is no reasonable basis, then
20%.
Well, Your Honor, what I'm suggesting is the insurance company can argue that at the point in time we received the additional information, we made the decision to pay the claim because it should be paid. When we first denied it, we didn't have that evidence. And I think that would go a long way in convincing a jury that they didn't breach their duty of good faith and fair dealing. Once they fully investigated, and they do have a duty to investigate fully, once they've done that, then they can reach another decision.
But when client calls you, the adjuster calls you, and adjuster says, would you just please write me an opinion letter on whether I should grant this claim or not, a lawyer would be somewhat daring to write an opinion letter out of the circumstances, wouldn't it?
Possibly, Your Honor. The problem, though, is that do we get into a situation where each side then has experts to opine whether there was no reasonable basis? So we're elevating it to another level of experts to come in and testify whether there was no reasonable basis, and the jury still has to make that determination. Ultimately, the jury's going to have to decide based on the testimony of the witnesses or experts of the sides or experts for the experts. It's ultimately a jury question.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, Court. My name is Steve Sumner. I represent Ms. Golda Lyons. I'm going to be dividing my time with Ms. Roberts, and I would like you to allow me to address the evidence and the application of the bad faith standard as set forth in the Aranda case.
Before you get into that,
yes, sir.
I need to deal with the very last question that I asked your opposing counsel of. That is concerning the whole question of whether you challenge the Court of Appeals alternative holding that there was no evidence of false misleading of the facts or practices. Why isn't that in this case for Ms. Lyons right there?
Your Honor, I believe it is incorporated in our writ, and I believe we have sufficiently challenged the Court of Appeals findings. I think that my argument, I think, will address that.
Okay.
In applying, before we apply the evidence, I'd like to remind the court that the law in Aranda, or the standard, set forth states that Miller, begs the question of whether Miller actually knew there was no reasonable basis to deny the claim, or based on its duty to investigate, Miller should have known that there was no reasonable basis for denial. In our case, in the Lyons case, there were two absolutely different theories by the parties. Ms. Lyons' basis for recovery was based on a windstorm that occurred on April 29th of 1984, and she maintained that there was damage to her house. The Miller's insurance maintained that there was no damage to her house, and any damage that existed was the result of a pre-existing condition. Thus, the issue of the pre-existing condition becomes paramount in the case, whether or not there was a pre-existing condition or whether or not the damage was caused by the windstorm. Mr. Hardy, who was the witness for Miller's, their expert witness, on question, do you have any way of telling us how long it had been in that condition prior to the storm? His answer is, it takes years rather than months or weeks. So now we know that this pre-existing condition, per their expert, didn't happen overnight. It took a period of years rather than months or weeks. The known evidence in the case is that Ms. Lyons possessed the policy from Miller's for 3 months and 11 days prior to the windstorm. The house was insurable 3 months and 11 days before, certainly within the time frame that Mr. Hardy had designated. Miller conducted no factual investigation in the neighborhood to determine whether or not there were any people, anyone who had any personal knowledge of whether or not the condition existed prior to the storm. So on the issue of the duty to investigate, I think that becomes important. Mr. Hardy further testified on page 381 of the transcript that when asked, do adjusters take statements? Yes, I think most of the time they do. That may be the standard that most of the time they do, but it didn't occur in the Lyons case. Ms. Lyons brought three witnesses that were uncontroverted that the condition did not exist prior to the storm, that there were no bricks falling off of the house, that there were, that the stairwell was usable, and so consequently, it was uncontroverted, it was unrebutted by Miller's. Miller brought opinion testimony only. No witnesses with personal knowledge of what the condition was prior to the storm, because they didn't investigate it. The jury...
How could you investigate before the storm?
I think a neighborhood survey of any sort, or if it had been existing for years, the milkman, the meter reader, anybody that would have gone in that backyard, Ms. Lyons was certainly a good source. There was a man who lived upstairs that no statement was ever taken from, who walked up and down those stairs per her testimony. So no statements were ever taken, and the only evidence that was presented for the fact finder in this case was opinion testimony. So all the jury could do was consider the credibility and weigh the testimony of opinion witnesses. The opinion witnesses raised a significant question that was discussed earlier, manufactured evidence, because Miller's hired an adjuster by the name of Benoit, whose responsibility, as their other expert had said, to take statements most of the time, did not do so. He hired his witness, Mr. Hardy, who we refer to in our writ as a hired gun, because he would qualify as a professional witness, I would submit, because he said he had testified somewhere close to 200 times that 80% of his business was derived from insurance companies and 80% of his income was derived from insurance companies. That was the basis for his opinion. After that basis for the denial, Ms. Lyons testified that Mr. Benoit refused to talk to her, hung up on her when she would try to call him, and so she reported him to the State Board of Insurance. After that, a second opinion was sought from Mr. Herman, and he was basically, we argued, a rubber stamp witness. See, my light is going off here. In conclusion, in applying the standard in Aranda, the question of based on the duty to investigate, should Miller have known? The question is, does the hiring of these hired guns who come up with a theory or an opinion, who conduct no investigation when there should have been plenty of witnesses that could have corroborated their opinion or supported their opinion, when Mr. Hardy says that there should have been statements taken most of the time and sets the standard, and most importantly, when the jury concluded that the witnesses were not credible and that this investigation was just a sham, then has the standard in Aranda been met? I submit that it had, in terms of proof that to support the basis that there had not been a reasonable basis to deny this claim.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thanks, sir.
May it please this honorable court. My name is Christine Carol Roberts, and I represent respondent Golda Lyons. I'm here to address point of error number 2, which deals with whether or not the Court of Appeals committed error in reversing the trial court's judgment that Miller's engaged in false, misleading, or deceptive acts or practices that were producing cause of Lyons' damages, because there was substantial evidence that Miller's did indeed engage in false, misleading, or deceptive acts in violation of the Texas Insurance Code 2121-16, as well as the Deceptive Trade Practices Act 1750. Petitioner argues that the pleadings do not support a finding of a deceptive act. Respondent amended her pleading 6 times, Your Honorable Court. six times to ensure that every conceivable cause of action could be brought before the court and before the jury at the trial level. In its second amended original petition, the respondent added the deceptive trade practices claim in March of 1987. At that time, Miller's acknowledged that there was a deceptive trade practices claim being made. They moved to abate and continue and for special exceptions in April of 1987. Respondent then again amended its petition a third, fourth, fifth, and sixth time to attempt to be more specific so that there would be no doubt in anyone's mind that they were raising a deceptive trade practice claim. It is our position that any claim with regard to the pleading or defective pleading has been waived by the petitioner at this time. In addition, under the pleading rules and under both 1746, which is being put up as a straw man, and 1750, which is the DTPA, and under which respondent pled and proved her cause of action, it was not necessary to plead 1746 specifically. The petition is replete with reference to false, misleading, unfair, and unconscionable acts by Miller's casualty. They're replete in the first cause of action, which was the breach of contract cause of action, and the second cause of action, which alleged violations of 2121 and Board Orders 18663, 41454, and 41060. And by way of example, and by example only, not meant to be an exclusive list of the conduct of the petitioner, the respondent listed A through G under Section .003 of Board Order 41454. That was not meant to be an exclusive list of the conduct. In paragraph 6, plaintiff alleged the negligence and breach of duty of the good faith and fair dealing, and again discussed the bad acts in terms of the failure to investigate and promptly pay the claim. In the fourth cause of action, the cause was headed Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Violation by Defendant Miller's Casualty. In cause of action number 7, respondent Lyons incorporated each preceding paragraph into paragraph 7, making reference to the deceptive, false, misleading, and unconscionable conduct. In paragraph number 8, respondent alleged unfair practices and civil conspiracy, again incorporating the conduct. We believe that this pleading was more than adequate under Rourke to put the petitioner on notice of the causes of action that were being alleged against Miller's casualty. The DTPA and the insurance code each grant relief for unfair and deceptive acts and practices in the business of insurance. They are not exclusive. So this court has properly held in Vail. In Vail, this court properly interpreted the legislative purpose of enacting 2121 and enacting 1750, all sections of 1750, not just section 3 or 4, but in fact the true purpose of the legislative intent was to provide a cause of action for the little guy to protect against the oppression of the insurance company. Arnold and Aranda both hold that an insurer's lack of good faith in handling a claim is, in and of itself, an unfair or deceptive act. Millers knew that we were pleading and attempting to prove a cause of action under the DTPA. We believe, as we've stated before, that our responses, that our pleadings met the Rourke test. In addition, Section 16 of Article 2121 incorporates any unlisted practice that is determined to be false, misleading, or deceptive. The jury in this case, the Lyons case, rightfully determined that the conduct of Miller's in handling Gold Alliance claim was false, misleading, deceptive, and unconscionable. Their entire course of conduct was unconscionable. We believe that we've pled and proven that they have engaged in both listed and unlisted deceptive trade practices. The legislative intent has mandated that the DTPA and the insurance code are to be liberally construed to promote the remedial purposes of those statutes.
Any questions? Thank you, Counsel. Will the audience please rise?
Could we return to the question
I asked you? Sure, that's what I want to address.
Good.
You asked whether you could whether we need the court needed to decide or the jury decided whether there was no reasonable basis because of a delay in determining to deny the claim. I think that's addressing something that's not that I don't understand is raised in Arnold or recognized in Arnold. It's no reasonable basis because of a wrongful denial of a claim or wrongful delay of payment or a failure to determine in the first place whether there is a reasonable basis. I don't think we have to deal with the failure to determine because it's not disputed that an investigation did occur and did occur within a month of the theft. The complaint appears to be that a letter didn't get to him until 90 days afterwards, but in the record, Mr. Moody testified that he received a phone call from Mr. Bernard Caesar, who is the New York Insurance Company for John Michael Pollan, telling Mr. Moody his claim was denied because the car was not being used for promotional purposes at the time it was stolen. And that's really what this case is about. Factually is whether the facts of the theft itself fall within the coverage or not.
Well, to separate for a moment the facts of this case from the principle that we're being asked to consider in this case, is delay a factor to be considered at all? I gather you're saying it doesn't make any difference how long it took.
Well, if the court is going to extend the duty to say a delay in determining a claim rather than a delay in paying a claim that where liability is reasonably clear, I think you're extending the duty to act even though there may ultimately be a reasonable basis for denial of the claim.
Right.
And the
mere fact that an insurer takes a year or two to decide whether there was a reasonable basis for denying the claim, that's not something that we ought to even consider.
A year or two to decide a claim?
Right. That's not part of the duty.
I think in that case that you're going to have other things other than the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. And certainly it would be a consideration because is there a reasonable basis for what is, in essence, a denial of the claim because no decision has been made?
Suppose there was a very good, solid basis for denying the claim, but the insurance company just didn't choose to assert that for a year or two.
Intentionally not tell or just negligently not tell?
Either way.
Well, isn't the insured going to be able to show there's no reasonable basis because they don't know what the insurance company's basis is?
Well, eventually they found out after a year or two.
Well, I guess this court is going to have to hold to reach this that regardless of whether a claim is covered, regardless of whether there is coverage under an insurance policy, there can be a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. That it has nothing to do with coverage. That means I can file a claim on somebody else's policy where there's absolutely no coverage, and when they deny it, I can sue them for bad faith. I don't have to have coverage. Now, a reasonable basis, if they don't tell me what you're not covered, Ms. Wilkins, well, can I prove that that's not a reasonable basis? If I don't know about it, I suppose I could. They didn't tell me why they just never answered my claim. I think that the court is extending the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. And delay in determining this case, it does away with the fact that the plaintiff has to establish no reasonable basis. He's got to negate the reasonable basis. And you're saying, and under what I'm hearing, is that the reasonable basis test just sort of goes out the window. Even if there is a reasonable basis, it doesn't matter. So I guess we're redefining what the duty of good faith and fair dealing is. If it's not going to be, there is no reasonable basis any longer, but it is the acts of the, and conduct and the
I'm
handling
not sure
of the claim.
Either of us, I'm not sure either of us heard Justice Doggett correctly on that. I presume his question was, is delay in either paying or denying a claim, presumably a valid claim, a factor to be considered in determining bad faith?
I think if it is a factor that contributes to no reasonable, to the unreasonableness of the denial, it's the unreasonableness of the delay.
Was their behavior unreasonable under the circumstances?
Well, is the delay unreasonable? And then the delay would be a factor in determining whether the delay in payment was there was no reasonable basis for the delay in payment or the delay in the denial. I guess you
it's
are.
It's just a factor. It's not the sole determining factor.
It's just like every other factor.
With this, but I don't think we're going anywhere.
Okay, I'm sorry. Well, it is a factor, Your Honor, and it's a factor just like it was brought up that Mr. Moody overvalued this vehicle. If you look at the letter that was sent to him, if you look at the application that he filed for this insurance company, he said it cost $40,000. And during the investigation they did, when it was stolen, they found out he only paid $30 for it. And that is a discrepancy that would certainly come, you know.
Excuse me. Is a bargain? Does a bargain affect market value if you buy a $42,000 vehicle for $30,000 and you get a deal? If market on it is $42,500 and you manage to get it for $30 because of some peculiar circumstances, maybe you just negotiated a hot deal, does that diminish the value of the property?
Well, I raised
the point that
there were some questions as to his valuation because they were looking at what he paid after they found out he only paid $30. The evidence that he got a good deal didn't come out till trial. So you're asking, you're trying to look at the conduct over here based on something that they don't find out about till later. And it certainly, it's evidence of
I'm sorry, wasn't there an estimate of market value of that vehicle of in excess of $42,500? It's really irrelevant what he paid for it. If someone had given it to him, it would be irrelevant. The question is the market value of the item. And what he paid for it is immaterial. The company never hesitated to insure it for that amount.
Well, all right. Let's go back. He's saying there are three bases for denying this claim. In the way I understand the doctrine of good faith and fair dealing, there has to be no reasonable basis. Does that mean if you have one, do all of them have to be reasonable? Doesn't he have to negate all of them? Or Arnold and Aranda don't mean what they say.
Thank you.
probably don't have much time to say, you know, what I want. On the DTPA issue, the second point of error in the Lyons case, if any error was preserved whatsoever on that point, it was only on the holding that there was no pleading to support the DTPA issue. They have not challenged the Court of Appeals holding that there was no evidence of a false, misleading, or deceptive act of practice. So that point of error can be overruled on that as well. If there is sufficient evidence which, if believed by a jury, would support a denial of a claim, this court ought to hold as a matter of law there is no bad faith. When Millers went to look at this house, they saw a house like this. This is a diagram of all the cracks in that house from the foundation settlement. These are the photographs that show the brick not only cracking, but actually falling away from the house by a foot or more. When an insurance company sends a contractor out who sees this, includes its settlement damage, when they send an engineer out later who sees the same thing, and he concludes its settlement damage, that insurance company has acted reasonably, has reasonably denied that claim. There is sufficient evidence in the record to support a denial. It's believed by a jury, and as a matter of law, there was no bad faith. My final point is on the application for writ of error filed by Millers.
Anybody have a question? What is that point?
I'm asking this court to render the contract claim for the failure of the insurer to properly submit the issue on the contract claim. Court of Appeals held that that issue erroneously reversed the burden of proof. It did not incorporate the entire exclusion. Also, there is no evidence to support their contract element of segregation of damages. I'm asking this court to follow the precedent set forth in the recent cases of State Department of Highways versus Payne and Southwestern Bell versus Delaney, where the plaintiff failed to make their case. This court rendered.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the arguments in the third and fourth cases. The court will now take a recess until 2 p.m.
The audience, please rise.